kids. That's Segundo here, and I seem to have a terrible case of indigestion. Last night, I somehow coaxed a blonde-haired vegan. Is that how you say it? I don't know. I can't keep up with all of these current lifestyle choices. Anyway, I got her to visit my motel room. We ordered portobello mushroom burgers, and I was a bit stunned by the lack of meat. I mean, how can you call a burger, when there's no burger to speak of? I mean, I don't call an African-American a spade simply because he looks like that particular card suit.
Usted racist, le petite!
Look, settle down, Jorge. Okay, bad example. I apologize to my African-American listeners. I love African-Americans. I can get down to it, groovy dog. Samuel L. Jackson is a badass. Some of my best friends are black. The taxi driver who drove me to the studio, he was black and certainly a nice man. Wait a minute, bad example. Look, the point here is that we often misunderstand each other or have false generalizations about what something is all about. And I suspect that the same goes for Jeff Vandermeer. Who is this man? A fantasy writer? As our young roving correspondent found out, he was a hell of a lot more.
There comes a time.
So I'm here with the one, the only, Jeff Vandermeer, two-time World Fantasy Award winner, author now of Shriek, as well as City of Saints and Mad Men. Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was a pleasure to read your books. Now, I understand that you wrote the first Ambergris novella, Drayden in Love, while you were recovering from a bad case of mono. Now, I'm wondering if this was one of the reasons why mushrooms tickled your fancy. Why mushrooms, first and foremost?
I think that they're relatively alien life forms in a sense. They already kind of exude a fantastical feel. There's even a type of mushroom that if you feed it, basically very small particles of iron filings, it will slowly turn to metal over time.
Uh-huh.
So there's all kinds of weird and interesting facts about mushrooms that that I just found fascinating, you know. And they say write about what interests you, so that's what I did, kind of. But the first part of your question, what was the first part?
Well, I was talking about how you wrote Drayden in Love while you were recovering from mono.
Yeah, the thing that was funny was not only did I have a low-grade fever during the whole thing, but I was also reading Steve Erickson's Art to X at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that put me in a really surreal mood to begin with, so I was very suggestible in terms of writing fantasy at the time.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, what was it about mushrooms that sort of attracted you? You were mentioning that you were reading up on mushrooms. Were you just studying, you know, the difference between portobello and you know, other mushrooms, or what?
I think, honestly, it's one of those things that I think comes out of the subconscious a little bit. Although I've been studying them, also, I didn't think I'd actually be writing about them to that extent. When I wrote that first scene that has the gray caps or mushroom dwellers in it in Drayden in Love, you know, the underground inhabitants of the city, I didn't, it wasn't planned. It just kind of came out, and then I just kind of went with it. A lot of times in my writing, I like the whole surrealist notion and painting of how they would take an uneven surface and they would paint over it, and then they would see what shapes suggested themselves to them from the whorls and the imperfections, and then they would kind of accentuate those and make them more detailed and real. And so sometimes when I write, that's what happens.
I also know
I see something in there that's not intentional to begin with, and then I make it intentional.
I also note that when I read City of Saints and Mad Men, I had to remark on the sort of, you kind of played God with these characters very similarly to T.C. Boyle in the sense that you put these characters in really, really terrible fates, like even in Drayden from the get-go. I'm wondering why you felt the need to sort of, like, you know, put these characters, or what possessed you? Are you sort of a kind of a sadistic kind of author?
I don't see myself as manipulating the characters so much as writing about characters who are already sometimes in extreme positions, mm-hmm. or in the grip of rather extreme obsessions. It's not something I really think about consciously. It's just how I perceive character. I mean, if you're going to have a character that transforms or in some way becomes other than what they are at the beginning of the story, it seems to me that that's kind of a gut-wrenching process. Mm-hmm. And I don't see it as something that, at least in the kind of setting that Ambergris is, something that's modulated more subtly, I guess would be the way to put it.
Shriek has been getting rave reviews, and yet the reviews I've read have found your approach something of a stumbling block. Publishers Weekly, for example, gave you a starred review, but they called Shriek masterful if difficult.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't find your novel difficult, maybe because I'm sort of used to postmodern elements that you throw into the book and I see in books, but I wanted to put forth the question to you. Since postmodernism has been declared dead by the likes of James Wood and B.R. Myers, do you think that genre is the way to revitalize it? Or?
I don't trust anyone who says any technique is dead. Mm-hmm. I mean, all we really have available to us as writers is our unique imagination and worldview, and then how we apply technique. And everybody, if you have the right approach, can revitalize a technique. And all postmodernism is a set of techniques that can be used for all kinds of things. It can break down the fourth wall, or it can reinforce in fantasy, for example, the reality of the place you're talking about. So I don't buy that argument to begin with. Any generalization you make about writing is wrong. And those writers should know better. But with regard to postmodernism, you know, I don't... It's funny, because in the fantasy genre, I think some reviewers have not been exposed that much to those techniques. And so to them, it is difficult sometimes. It is new. I don't see myself as a real experimenter. I see myself as kind of a renovator, kind of reapplying something in a way it might not have been used before. And so, you know, I don't see it as being difficult either. It's a pretty straightforward narrative in some ways.
I guess some people perhaps are still used to the notion, as you say, of reading about like a straight kind of, I guess, bugs and flying saucers kind of story. And then when they actually see something that, I guess, represents the new weird, like one of your stories or one of M. John Harrison's or even China Mieville's stories, it's sort of like, oh, well, this is entirely different. And it sort of maybe throws them for a loop. I mean, do you think that there is, do you think that the new weird school, so to speak, is what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that this is the way to kind of march speculative fiction forward to a new respectability? What do you think accounts for, you know, all of the, I guess, the so-called new weird philosophy that we've seen a lot in the last
years? Well, I mean, first of all, it's not that, I guess it's a more subtle distinction with the reviewers. I mean, I think they're a lot more sophisticated than the duality you're discussing there, the difference between them seeing a simple flying saucer story and something more complex. They are used to more complex structures, but there isn't a whole lot of what I would call strict postmodernism in fantasy fiction. Mm-hmm. So that particular area is sometimes new to them. But the other question about new weird is, you know, that's as far as I'm concerned, not even a movement. It's hardly even a footnote. It's basically conjoining a bunch of authors who happen to write about fantastical cities who are otherwise vastly different in approach and kind of trying to lump them all together in a way that I find totally unuseful. I mean, when I think about writing, I think about theme and character, and I don't make those kinds of connections. I don't say, well, all these books are set in fantastical cities, so they're somehow similar. You know, I look at the themes. You know, are they dealing, they're talking about sex, are they dealing with death, love, what are they doing? And I make connections between mainstream literary and fantasy books in that way. I don't really see fantasy as this thing that's this separate entity that has all these similarities just because there's some fantastical element in it. So I don't find new weird at all, and I don't like the term at all, because I think it's kind of limiting in how you can talk about a book then.
Well, a lot of people, when the so-called new wave in science fiction came along, a lot of the authors who were identified as new wave said, what are you talking about? I'm just writing the fiction.
Yeah.
So.
No, I think new wave was a little more legit, though, because the core of that was a bunch of writers living in London.
Yeah.
Who had a lot of, you know, interconnectivity with one another and cross-pollination. You know, but, you know, you talk about someone like China Mieville, who came up with new weird, and then associated with me, and it doesn't even make any sense. I mean, it's a totally different generational thing. You know, I was writing back in the 80s. I wrote Drayden in Love in 1992, and that's supposedly a new weird text. And sure, you can go back and backfill in texts, you know, after you've come up with your theory of how they're connected. But in terms of influence and things like that, we're not really riffing off of each other. These authors are supposedly all new weird. And I think that's kind of important, at least from my perspective, is, you know, who am I being influenced by? And it's not those people.
So you see New Weird almost as kind of a pejorative label, somewhat similar to Chick Lit. But then again, you know, one might argue that, you know, having a taxonomy is kind of helpful for people to understand.
It's helpful for marketing and sales. it's been very useful with like Matt and Mentor for them to understand the basic parameter of how they can sell the work. Again, I don't find it useful otherwise. It's nice to think that these kinds of labels can be useful, and they make fiction more comfortable for people, I think, in a way. But they limit discussion. It's kind of like writing workshops where you'll hear terms like white room to describe a lack of description in a story or something like that, and you find yourself eventually dealing in these generalities and these cliches that don't get you any closer to specificity of detail. Mm-hmm. And that's what good fiction is all about. So again, you know, I just have to reject labels in general as much as possible on the artistic side. It's totally different on the career PR side, I guess.
So if some critic were to say, hey, this is Vandermeerian, we're going to have to go ahead and throw that label aside.
No, I mean, I understand it's useful. It's just, it's not useful to me artistically. And I primarily try and think of the core of it is to think of it that way, not think in terms of how it helps your audience, I guess.
Okay.
Otherwise, I feel like if I start thinking in those terms, I'll actually kind of betray my audience in a way.
Gotcha. Well, I want to talk about Shriek and the perspectives that you have. You have Janice's direct comments, and you have Duncan's parenthetical comments.
Yeah.
And, I was wondering if you had difficulties confining Duncan's observations to parentheses, because you strike me as a very tangential writer. And I was wondering, you know, were there any moments in Shriek where you kind of just had to, as you were writing it, you were sort of saying, oh my God, I can't actually use parentheses because then the reader's going to get confused because this is actually Duncan talking. And was this an effort on your part to kind of confine your energies towards progressing the story forward and kind of eliminating your own sort of natural tangential impulses? Or?
I think it was a way to control, but I was mostly concerned about how to build up three-dimensional portraits of these characters. And I like the idea of characters telling different versions of the same story, not the same scene, because that's boring as far as I'm concerned, but you know, in some sense, and I was worried about the parentheses a little bit, but then we tried, you know, actually in like the proof stage, all kinds of other things like different typefaces and things like that, and it just looked too tricky. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I also think that the parentheses get the point of Duncan's asides across, which is that they're more important than footnotes, but they're not as important as the main text in a way, although they do build up a kind of a layering effect. But, you know, I did actually imagine in general him, you know, making annotations in the margins. Mm-hmm. Although I didn't need the rough draft to do that, I did use the parentheses because it was just easier.
Gotcha. Now, when did Duncan's perspective kind of come into the writing of Shriek? Did you kind of write the thing with Janice's kind of perspective and then you kind of added Duncan as you went along? Or did you actually go back through sort of...
No, I considered the Duncan text in the first draft placeholder because I knew it was going to change.
Okay.
Throughout, so it was there from the beginning, but it changed a lot. In the first draft, he was a lot bitchier, and he was making a lot more tiny little sarcastic comments, and you know, it wasn't adding much to the novel. So I considered that to be kind of like placeholder stuff until I could like modulate it better, get a sense of how he would actually add to the novel, how he would actually comment too. You know, if this was an actual document or manuscript. And went from there. But he was always integrally part of it. In the first draft also, though, his parentheticals come as a surprise, which is to say you're reading along and you're reading these parenthetical statements and you think they're from Janice, and then at a certain point you realize they're from Duncan.
Yeah.
But at some point there didn't seem any point in disguising it because it's already something that's not familiar to the reader. So the one concession that I made was to make it clear up front that the parentheticals are his... observations, and in the Tor edition, they've done these very ornate parentheticals, so it's a little more obvious. It stands out from the text a little bit more, from Janice's text.
Gotcha. Well, there's also a conscious effort on your part with Shriek to lay back on the footnotes, the appendices, and the illustrations, although at the end of the book, I noted that you couldn't quite resist throwing in a few pictures. But did you set any sort of ground rules on how much ephemera you were going to actually include in this book? Was there like a bare minimum percentage, or what did you do? I mean, because it seems
That's
to
a
me
good question. I mean, I have been labeled as being too clever for my own good sometimes, especially with City of Saints. Although that book, I thought required those kinds of things. You know, mm-hmm. the illustrations, the footnotes, things like that. In this, I just wanted to tell. not need that material. It wouldn't add anything to it. You know, the parentheticals add something, but all the rest of the stuff, not so much. And in fact, I had some interesting discussions with my various publishers because they had loved the layout of City of Saints so much that they were like, well, what, shouldn't we add footnotes? Shouldn't we add attribution? Shouldn't we add illustrations? And I was like, no, this is the story of this brother and this sister and what they go through and what the city of Abergris goes through during the period of their lives. Mm-hmm. And that's the focus. City of Saints is much more kind of a puzzle book, puzzle box of a book. And for that reason, those tricks, at least, you know, for most readers, work. But here, I thought it would have just been distracting and irritating and not important. And besides, I've already done that. I don't like to repeat myself. I don't like to write the same book twice. Mm-hmm. So there was no point in treading water, so to speak.
Gotcha. Well, I was also astonished. I read an SF Site interview with Matt Cheney in 2004. It was a very great surprise to learn that despite the fact that there's extensive mythology for Ambergris, you actually hadn't written any of the City of Saints stories with outlines, but that you actually have retroactively outlined. Now, since Shriek is very much a reimagining of the Ambergris universe, what steps did you take to sort of sort through the mythology that you had set down? Because there's a lot of stuff in this. Did you have, like, Faulkner maps and diagrams of Ambergris lying about? Or what did you do to kind of corral through the sort of the great kind of world you created here?
Well, what I did is basically I wrote Shriek without reference to anything else. I mean, just what was in my head. And let the cards fall where they would, basically, and did what was right for Shriek. And where there are inconsistencies in City of Saints, I went back and changed things for the Bantam edition. Mm-hmm. I don't think an author is under any obligation to be consistent in that way if it's going to hurt the current story he's telling. And so that's what I did. And so City of Saints in the Bantam edition is slightly different from the previous versions for that reason. But also reimagining it was easy because this is the first time I've written about Ambergris from a first-person narrator's point of view, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a couple of individual stories in City of Saints that are done that way. But this is the first time in less of a pseudo-Victorian Baroque style, even though the style is still kind of rich and convoluted. And so I just let Janice's voice basically reimagine the city and reimagine, you know, the whole milieu for me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that worked out nicely.
Now, I know that scholars and scholarly discourse are also a pivotal part of the Ambergris universe. I was wondering what attracts you to this. Did you have some sort of, like, you know, education in your previous life before a writer that kind of caused you to sort of,
well,
like...
Well, you know, I had a lot of great teachers in college, but I also had a lot of very suspect ones. I mean, I began to see, and also through my dad's work, he's an entomologist working on fire ants, and I would see the hell he'd go through to get scientific papers published and begin to see how science and the study of literature are not in any way precise, you know, precise things, not as objective as you might think, and are extremely influenced by the personalities of the people involved.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, with history, that also applies in that you get many historians whose view of the world is so you know, influenced by their own personal lives. You know, I mean, I can't remember what historian it was, but I remember one account of the historian who admitted that he had been going through a divorce while writing this thing on this obscure period of Byzantine history, and it had totally influenced how he how he saw the time period. And so that fascinates me, is the idea of the subjectivity in areas that we think are objective. But also, I just think it's a good source for humor, and also for kind of building the authenticity of this secondary world. You know, because it is one thing you have to consider, just like a historical novelist has to consider, is how are people going to buy into the background that you're setting up, and that tends to help.
Well, one thing you do in the sort of scholars with these books is that there is no peer review. It's very much a kind of, you know, underground sort of scholarly sort of society. And going back to this point, this reminds me of the historian in Shriek who says that the history is influenced by politics and Mary Sabon takes objection to this. But what kind of, I guess it seems to me that there's almost a kind of parallel form of academies, so to speak, that you explore. And I guess you almost like reinvented the notion of what scholarly discourse is all about.
Well, I think I actually kind of, I mean, I'm basically an absurdist at heart. And so the absurdism of the whole perceived the whole absurdism of being able to really, I mean, I guess at heart I don't really believe in literary criticism to some extent, and believe that what we're reading is a fiction that's not even really about the fiction that it's discussing, and so that's kind of what I'm getting at. But I just find a great opportunity for humor, absurdism, for pointing out kind of the ridiculousness of the human condition through these types of statements and individuals. At the same time, you know, they are real people, and Duncan Shriek is a real person, you know, who, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought real fast.
No worries, I'll lose mine, I'm sure, too, so.
What was the question again?
Well, I was kind of commenting upon the underground scholarly sort of invention that you have, which is a complete alternative.
Yeah, it's definitely not fair. I mean, to some extent, like I said, it's kind of exaggerated and absurdist. And because most of the scholars are kind of portrayed as being not fools, but not necessarily knowing the whole truth. Mm-hmm. But in terms of underground scholarship, I'm not really sure how to respond to that.
I was more like I wanted to kind of get the motivations for, you know, you had this background where your father was an entomologist,
oh, right.
and what kind of caused you to reinvent scholarly discourse as opposed to, you know, having parallels with peer review and the like. That's kind of what I was getting at.
Well, because I don't think that would be really as interesting. And sometimes when I plug stuff into Ambergris, it just kind of naturally mutates. It's not really something that I think about. Again, I really get into writing a lot through, like, texture and tone, and sometimes that will then just naturally influence the way that stuff is portrayed. But I also like the whole idea of dealing with the history stuff, again, because of the subjectivity, because it begins to get to the idea of there being a very limited consensus reality, if there is one at all. I'm very interested in the way that we piece together information, the way that we tend to think we know the truth or know what reality is, but really only have some clues about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one might argue that the entire structure of Shriek, there is no objective way to read it, really.
Some readers have even read it as it being a construct, a fiction written by the editor, who has the editor note at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can read it a few different ways. And what's also interesting to me is just in terms of how readers read things is how different the sympathies are. Some people really identify with Janice, some really identify with Mary, some identify with Duncan, and some of them just hate certain characters and love others, but it's never consistent, which to me is good because it means that I've done my job of not really necessarily passing judgment. I mean, Janice Shriek passes judgment on characters in there, but that's not me, that's her. Mm-hmm. And so I think I've been relatively successful in what I wanted to do in terms of layering these relatively complex characters.
Well, there's also one other interesting thing about Shriek, and that is the sort of emotional heft that you provide. Like, the Mary Duncan storyline in particular reminded me of this kind of Graham Greene sort of tale of longing, you know?
Yeah.
And that was definitely new to the books, but at the same time, there's also a sly reference later in the book to when Janice is contemplating what to do after the war, to Thomas Wolfe's A Stone, A Leaf, An Unfound Door. It's decidedly classier than Stephen King's usage of it from The Dark Tower, but... And then, of course, there's, you know, the influence of Gormenghast. It seems to me that this book in particular, but your work in general, is very rooted in early 20th century literary influences. What is it about this time period that kind of inspires you more than contemporary literature or even 19th century literature? Maybe I'm totally off base here. But
I don't know. I think that it's easy to confuse the setting with an influence,
yeah.
Because the setting is still kind of in that mode. But, I mean... All I can say is, like, you know, one of my biggest influences, especially for this book in some ways, is Nabokov. I mean, one of the biggest influences of anything I ever read was reading Lolita, because of the fact that encoded into that book is a characterization of Lolita that's totally separate from Humbert's, recollection of her. That
sure.
Somehow Nabokov manages to make us see her separate from that perspective. But, you know, I read a lot of contemporary stuff, and I'm always picking up technique from it. I love Gormenghast. I love things like that. I don't really see the tie-in per- personally, to Shriek. You know, I also am a huge fan of Angela Carter and writers like that. So those are slightly more contemporary. It's still dead. So.
Gotcha. Well, also, the interesting thing is, like, there are elements from City of Saints and Mad Men that you didn't actually pursue with the same kind of gusto in Shriek that you did in City of Saints. Like, for example, the River Moth is only there as a kind of reference point as opposed to sort of this Conrad-like sort of snake river. I was wondering what, in retelling this myth, did you find yourself deliberately disposing of certain elements? What was the criteria for, you know...
I kind of felt like City of Saints was the kind of book where, you know, everyone talked about the city being a character in it, as vivid as the other characters. And I saw City of Saints as something where, yes, the city was as three-dimensional as the characters, or whatever, however you want to say it, or as stylized as the characters. And I saw Shriek as something where the characters needed to be in the foreground, and the city had to kind of be in the background, and not as three-dimensional in a way as it was in City of Saints. So that was my real criteria, is making sure that the plot was really... that the city didn't somehow impinge as much on the plot and on the characters, and so it does kind of recede into the back a little bit. It comes to the fore a little bit more towards the war sequences, but, you know, again, this is a book that's very much about this interplay of relationships and lives, and the city is, you know, integral to it in a way in terms of the events that affect their lives, but it's not the be-all and end-all in the way it is in City of Saints.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, I often felt while I was writing it, you know, when I would step back from it, not when I was during the rough draft phase, like I was basically writing a mainstream relationship book that just happened to be set in an imaginary place, you know. And of course, that's the weird thing about Ambergris, is nothing fantastical ever takes place in it, you know. It's still, you know, everything in it could take place in the real world, even the mushroom dwellers to some extent. Although I guess they're not. They're still so mysterious that it's kind of difficult to tell.
Sure. Well, also, the war between the houses is something new to the mythology in this book. And not only that, but also Ambergris itself is a far more dangerous locale this time around than City of Saints. I was wondering if you were influenced possibly by certain current events, or maybe...
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the Iraq War was going on while I was, you know, revising and writing new sections of the book. And it was the kind of book where everything around me fit in some way. You know, there's certain novels, when you write them, the whole world more or less becomes part of the book in some way, if it's the right kind of book. And Shriek was a big enough book and a big enough setting that was happening. And so, you know, there's scenes in there, like there's a scene in there where, the Grey Caps actually kind of give... weaponry to one side in the conflict, and that includes these fungal bullets. Just a totally different type of technology than we're used to, and after you shoot someone with them, they become inert, and they're actually edible. And so there's a scene in there, I believe, where there are people actually so hungry because there's no other food that they're picking these bullets out of their loved ones' bodies and eating them.
Yeah.
And that I got directly out of Afghanistan, where we were dropping bombs, and then we were dropping aid packets. The only problem was the aid packets were the same color and shape as the bombs, so nobody touched them for months. Mm. You know, so those kinds of ironies and juxtapositions definitely were transferred and transformed in the war sections of Shriek, and made it slightly more powerful because of it. I wouldn't say, though, that Shriek's a comment on the Iraq War so much as the war sections are just trying to portray a war setting realistically.
Gotcha. But also, you know, Ambergris goes from this kind of, like, body sort of place to a place that's, like, you know, almost like, you know, Sarajevo or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, you know, that's like real cities, you know. I mean, Beirut now isn't as dangerous as it was in the 80s. Cities go through these periods where they are, you know, completely devastated or ruined, and yet somehow come back from that. I am in Shriek angling towards things that happened in the later books. There are two more books in the cycle, and so there is some suggestion in the setting and that danger you're talking about of what's to come in the later books.
Gotcha. Well, I also wanted to ask you to kind of shift gears here. Yeah. Albemuth Boulevard reminded me very much of Hollywood Boulevard for some reason. I mean, and also the two names share the exact same number of syllables. So I have to ask you, what sort of street is Albemuth Boulevard inspired from, would you say? Is it a kind of confluence of, you know, certain kind of avenues that you've walked down in the past or that you're aware of? Or?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's really drawn from childhood memories of walking down certain streets in Rome or Madrid. Mm-hmm. Certain streets in Bangkok, and certain streets in cities in India, and really just when you're that age, everything's kind of a confusion of colors and motion. Everything seems kind of patchwork and incredibly fresh and new, and so really I was just thinking of, you know, a vast artery of trade basically, and a vast artery of people and businesses and just kind of a confusion of an overload of the senses in a sense, but I wouldn't think of any particular boulevard.
Huh. Well, what about the Squid Festival?
Yeah, the Squid Festival. I think that was actually in Fiji. We used to celebrate the Diwali, a Hindu festival, because there's a large Indian population in Fiji. And I just remember the crepe paper lanterns and some of the floats and other festival things. And I think that's where that came from originally. It's again, you know, I think one reason that I turned to a non-realistic place as a setting for the majority of my fiction in this phase of my life is that it allows me to kind of reconcile all those places I went to as a kid. You know, I never really had a fixed sense of place, you know. So I couldn't really, you know, write out of, you know, like Faulkner did, out of one particular place, or even Stephen King with Maine, you know, in terms of one consistent place. And Ambergris, in a way, allows me to reconcile all of those different settings in a way that makes sense. And so a lot of those things you're talking about are, again, all childhood memories from when we were overseas.
Gotcha. Now, is Ambergris based off of, in any way, Roger Zelazny's Amber, or...?
No. And it's actually kind of funny because I believe the German translation is almost the exact same as the Zelazny title, and so there's been some confusion over there as to which book is which. But no, I've read some of those books, but there's no connection otherwise.
Okay. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was, well, actually, I wanted to go back to what we were talking about earlier about the ephemera. I don't think we really got into this about what makes City of Saints have more ephemera than Shriek, which is more of a kind of straight kind of storytelling, or what kind of limits you sort of set. I mean, is ephemera something that when you actually go ahead and write an Ambergris story, something that's kind of ineluctable in the writing process, that you can't sort of stop yourself from, you know, even putting like sort of italics for dialogue that's in the future or some, you know, I mean, to what sense are you kind of...
Well, I mean, you're talking about Shriek, right?
I am talking about Shriek.
Was just to differentiate it from, so that it'd be clear that it's not quite part of the present. But you know, I only use the ephemera when I think it helps the story in some way, when I think it's essential to the story. Because there are some pseudo experimental or revisionist type techniques used in City of Saints. And so, you know, like King Squid in City of Saints, the genesis of that story, which is in the form of a scientific monograph about squid, was that here's a character who has committed a terrible crime and both wants to hide it and confess to it at the same time. How would he do that? And in this particular case, you know, the form of the scientific monograph made sense because he was actually somebody who considered himself a scientist studying squid, and so this allowed him kind of a comfortable format in which to begin his story as a monograph and end it as a confession. Mm-hmm. And so I don't really think of the type of thing that I think you're talking about as being grace notes so much as essential to the overall structure of whatever it is I'm working on. Usually out of character.
Gotcha. But I mean, like, you know, you were mentioning, like, even in an early draft of Shriek that you were, you know, thinking about different typefaces for how to integrate the Duncan comments.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, to be more direct, is to what extent is, you know, style kind of naturally ingrained in your writing when you approach an Ambergris story?
Well, as I think I said previously, I write into stories through the tone and the texture, mm-hmm. and it's always slightly different for each story. It's very much by feel. Like I said, I don't do much outlining. I don't really. All I really do when I start a story is I know the basic form of it. I know the tone or texture of the prose I'm going to use, and I know something about the ending, something about what the characters want. And then from there, the complexity kind of builds on that. I don't know if this is a style versus substance kind of question, but I don't see any division between the two. The things that I come up with, they all kind of come together naturally. They may not be fully expressed in the first draft, but I don't think of them, these things, as separate. There's no separation there.
I wasn't actually trying to imply that there was. I was just trying to kind of get a sense of what kind of motivates the sort of stylistic impetus behind the substance that is already right there. You know, that's kind of what my question was here.
Right. Well, I mean, basically, like I said, again, it just depends on who the characters are and what tone and texture is right for the story, and then what structure. Mm-hmm. I don't experiment just for, you know, its own sake, generally. You know, sometimes I'll you know, like the glossary in City of Saints is there because I had a bunch of little tiny mini tales I wanted to tell and nowhere to really put them, and so I thought, well, I'll put it in a glossary and hopefully people will read it the way they will a real glossary, which is to say, look up things every once in a while. But sometimes people don't read non-fiction forms used in fiction the way you think they would.
Yeah.
I had one reviewer who read the Fake Disease Guide, for example, all the way through, and didn't like it. And it's like, yeah. Well, no shit, because you're supposed to browse through that the same way you would a medical dictionary. So sometimes I think people find the forms more artificial than they really are, because they're not thinking about the context, the nonfiction context that's been pulled from.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, like, I read City of Saints. I read it, like, kind of one novella at a time,
yeah,
where that was the only way I could really sort of read it and sort of take in the world. And yeah, I think that anyone who would have read City of Saints in, like, one big burst, similar kind of thing, they'd have that similar kind of feeling.
Yeah, where... I mean, it is very dense, that particular book, you know. But on the other hand, you know, also when I use the experimental stuff, I usually inject there's a certain amount of humor involved,
yeah,
you know, like in the early history or in King Squid, because, you know, I know that myself that the one thing that I really despise more than anything else is first of all, experimentation for its own sake, and then, yeah, experimentation that isn't balanced in some way, that takes itself too seriously.
Well, sure, certainly, like, you know, I think the best experimentation is very playful, and certainly that, yeah, was Nabokov's impulse, too, yeah, you know.
Well, I think that's, I mean, getting back to your question about ephemera, that's really what is involved, too, is a sense of play. Mm-hmm. I find those to be a form of play, and I find that when I include those things, readers respond to them, and that's also a reason why I restricted them in Shriek, because I felt in a way like I was beginning to fall into a pattern, mm-hmm. and I don't like doing that. I like every book I start to feel like it's the first book I've ever written, and to get that sense of holy shit, I don't know if I can do this, I don't know if I can complete this, you know, what the heck am I doing? Because that's really the only way I'm going to grow as a writer, yeah.
Well, going back to an earlier question, one of the first questions I asked you about this sense of play,
yeah,
you know, there's this, James Wood, for example, declares, like, there's a struggle that we must fight, that these terrible sort of playful authors here are sullying hard realism, and Richard Yates and all this jazz. Now, I mean, I like Richard Yates, but
yeah,
but the point, why do you think there's so many people who object to the nature of playful prose, whether it's...
I don't think they have the right imagination. I mean, it is a question of imagination. I mean, that's really what we're engaging when we engage in that form of play.
Yeah.
And some people don't want to do that, or they can't, or they think somehow, you know, that literature always has to be serious with a capital L, and, you know, I just tend to ignore those people, because there's such a wide, you know, we have such a great series of choices in front of us right now in terms of types of literature. I don't understand the point of singling one branch or type out for some kind of censure. I mean, it would make more sense if he was going to focus on a particular work by a particular author only,
yeah,
and stick to that, you know, or part of a particular work. Then I would begin to pay attention to him and say, and then judge the merits of his argument. But again, you know, when you get into generalities, it's kind of the same thing as when writers in workshops teach their own anecdotal evidence about how they got where they are as the way you're supposed to do something as a writer. Mm-hmm. It's just false. It's just false. And but again, I think it's just kind of a lack of a certain type of imagination.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you actually got into this question a little bit with Dan Green, actually, at the reading experience. You two got into kind of...
I mean, I kind of overreacted, but then the way he expresses things is sometimes a little too pompous for me, so...
Yeah, okay. Well, gotcha. Well, the publicity of this book is actually rather interesting because you're single-handedly shepherding 15 shriek parties as well as a 10-minute movie.
Yeah.
This may be one of the most elaborate publicity campaigns I think I've ever seen an author whip up. How did this all come about? Was this a case where you kind of approached people who you knew were going to go ahead and unleash these kind of extravagant plans? Or...
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing is, you know, Shriek took 8 years to write, and I knew I was going to need a year off to just write shorter stuff. So I knew I wasn't going to be working on a novel this year.
Yeah.
So I said, well, what can I do creatively that's going to stretch me a little bit? And the answer was write the script for a movie. And in this case, what made the most sense was to do part of Shriek as a movie. And originally, that was it. You know, that was the only plan. And then, you know, when I got together with the PR marketing department at my publisher, you know, they were asking me what plans I had for the movie, and then things kind of went ahead that way. And, you know, there's different types of creativity.
You cut out there. Hang on, Jeff? Yeah, you cut out for some reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah, hang on 1 second here. Let me see what happened.
Okay.
Oh, there you are. You're back.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, no problem.
Where were we? Okay, yeah. So the way that these things tend to work is the same way that they tend to work for, like, anthologies I edit and things like that. Like, the Fate Disease Guide was supposed to be a chapbook,
yeah.
And then it was supposed to be 100 pages, and then before I knew it, it was 12 o'clock one night, and I was like, well, we really need this piece of fiction translated into Spanish as if it's from a fake book by Borges. So, really, it's just that things layer and accumulate, and that happens in the novels, that happens in the things I edit anthology-wise, to try and reach the kind of the real fruition of the possibility there. And that's really kind of what's happened with the Shriek stuff. What really energized it is that the church who did the soundtrack for it happened to be touring in the U.S. in August, the same time the book and the movie are coming out. Yeah. So things kind of snowballed from there. And like last week, I felt like I'm kind of becoming a booking agent more than anything else. It was kind of funny, actually. But you know, it's basically a groundswell of support at the fan base level, because I just put an email out to the people on my newsletter and said, hey, you know, would you like to host a party? You know, this is the stuff we can provide. We can provide the movie, et cetera, et cetera. And we got responses from people in, like, you know, 17 or 18 cities, and then we patched that in with the church's fan base. And so these are just kind of really nice little events that are kind of rewards for the people who like both the church's music and my books. And but that's still kind of secondary to what the main point was, which was to create this cool movie using the constraints of having a low budget to work in our favor.
Yeah.
You know, so it's actually been a really interesting experiment in form, I think. The film, that is.
Yeah, well, it seems also that this kind of so-called booking agent status that you've kind of taken it upon yourself is almost as ambitious as the kind of works that you actually do.
Yeah, it's well. I mean, I consider these things kind of a challenge,
yeah.
And so it's been interesting from kind of a networking and just a connectivity point of view how to set them up, and I'm learning a lot about it. And the fact of the matter is that you know, it's true what they say: the large publishers, just like small publishers, have their constraints, and there's things they can do for you and things they can't.
Sure.
And I really, really believe in this book, and I really want it to get attention. And so, you know, this is what I'm doing.
Well, speaking of publishing, I mean, I wanted to kind of go back into Shriek just really quick. And there was the kind of long monologue that was delivered in Shriek. You know, it seemed very much it seemed very much one of these sort of speeches that kind of came from a very kind of personal place, to from what I detected anyway. And it was one of the high points of the book.
Yeah, so it's a long rant from this publisher who, you know, calls Duncan Shriek into his office to basically reject his book in an unorthodox way. And so what I did is, you know, a lot of people think I'm very prolific, and it's not. I'm not really very prolific. It's just that for 10 years, everything I wrote was pretty much rejected in terms of the long form.
Uh-huh.
Menace Underground, City of Saints, all that stuff. until kind of the publishing atmosphere changed. Fantasy that was more literary became more acceptable. The term New Weird came up, all that kind of stuff. So what I did is I kind of channeled all of that emotion from 10 years of not being able to get published into the form of that publisher rant, which actually is something that I like reading because it gets quite a response, a humorous response from audiences, especially in New York City, where the audiences tend to be composed a lot of writers and editors and publishers. So.
Well, it's so over the top, but yet at the same time, it's also plausible in some weird way.
Well, the thing that's great about it is that Janet Schreck is given to hyperbole, so you never really know how accurate she is anyway, so I figured I'd take the chance and put it in there, even though I wasn't quite sure if it fit in terms of tone. But yeah.
Well, I'm going to wrap this up very soon, but actually I wanted to touch upon a piece of writing advice that is now circulating around, in which you suggest that physical exercise is the great secret to getting writing done.
Yeah.
Now, you're on record also that stating that you write anywhere from 20 to 40 hours a week. You have a full-time job.
Yeah.
Is this something, you know, and also you respond to your emails second only to Jonathan Ames in terms of, like, replying so fast. Now, you're 37 right now, but can you keep this thing up for, like, you know, into your 40s, your 50s, your 60s, or?
No, I mean, you know, right now I'm doing all this other stuff that isn't writing.
Yeah.
I am not actually doing that much writing right now this year. But that's a conscious decision, you know. I mean, you have to make sure you're not guilting yourself over not writing. So no, I can't maintain this pace. But I'm also going part time at the job next year.
Okay.
The PR stuff will begin to die down, you know. And there are long periods when I was writing Streak where I just went into a shell for months and sometimes even a year, and I wouldn't be very communicative about anything. So, but with regard to physical exercise, I'm absolutely serious. I mean, I just went to St. Alm's College in New Hampshire to teach something called Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I make these beginning writers do is I make them, in longhand, write continuously, automatic writing, for 15 minutes. Their pen cannot leave the paper. They must continue to write the entire time. And after 10 minutes, you know, they're complaining about fatigue.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, writing is a physical activity. It also takes a lot out of you mentally, which has to do with the physicality issue as well. And if I was still in the shape I was 3 years ago when I was 75 pounds heavier and wasn't going to the gym all the time, there's no way I'd be able to do this stuff because I wouldn't have the energy for it. Mm-hmm. So I do preach that a bit. You know, a lot of the things that I tell beginning writers are very simple because I don't believe in transferring anecdotal evidence that really just applies to my career path. But there are certain things that I think are very valuable. And sometimes the students will look at me like, well, that's very simple, you know, that's like it's too simple. But when they actually experience what I'm talking about, they begin to realize that sometimes that's the best advice.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, you can't never underestimate the sort of obdurate mind of a young writer who doesn't actually realize that, you know, getting rest and actually recharging the brain cells is conducive to actually getting those brain cells to operate.
Well, that's true, because I'm practically an old man now, right?
Yeah.
So I need, you know, I'll probably have a cane in a couple years, but and I sometimes feel that way, you know, because I've been writing and being published since I was about 15 or 16, so for me, I feel like, sometimes I feel like I'm 50, to be honest, so.
Gotcha. Well, Jeff, thank you very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Great to talk to you. Fuck that up. Great to talk to you, too.
Okay, yes, it's on the tape, so. Hello? Again. I said, wait, first try this hallucinogen. It's better than heroin, hand the booze in the gin. Come here, let's go in here. Who's in the den?
It's me and Kelly.
My bad. Let's try another room.
Trust you.
Shut up, slut, chew up this mushroom. This will help you get in touch with your roots. We'll get barefoot, butt naked, and run in the woods.
Oh, hell, I might as well try him. This party is so drag.
Oh, dang, I ain't